books, music, authors, food. It's time for the 25th annual Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. The Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading is coming up on Saturday, and on today's program, we're speaking to a few of the featured authors. Mark Helprin is the critically acclaimed best-selling author of Winter's Tale, In Sunlight and in Shadow, and A Soldier of the Great War, among others. His new novel is Paris in the Present Tense, whose protagonist, Jules Lacour, is a man in his 70s, a professional cellist, a survivor of the Holocaust, living a quiet life in Paris when he has to confront a series of emergencies and confront his own ideas about right and wrong.
I had spent so much of my life in Paris. My father moved us there when I was three. And when I was three and four, Paris was, this was just after the war. I always thought of it as the center of the world, even though I'm an American.
Did it feel like home?
Yeah, it feels like the home that I should actually have. I mean, I've had a lot of those. I've lived in 45 different places. That's the first one where I actually realized that I was not the world, but only a part of it.
And the Paris that you describe, you're not at the Eiffel Tower. You're not in the famous tourist parts of Paris. You're in the quiet residential neighborhoods of Paris in this book.
Mm-hmm. When I go to a city, I go to the suburbs. I go to schools. I go to factories, parks, where the people live. And that's where you can really observe the culture.
And you decide to talk about anti-Semitism.
It's a tremendous problem in France. France has lots of problems. There's an enormous problem of violence and unassimilated country that is within France. And as we know, this creates ongoing problems, and they haven't been able to solve them. One byproduct of it is anti-Semitism in France. It's very dangerous for Jews in France now. Many have left. Jews are killed, tortured. They're afraid to walk on the street with anything that identifies them. And there are essentially zones in France which are, they call them non-Zionist zones, but what they are really is like Judenfrei zones.
And you felt like this was urgent enough that your character, Jules, in this book had to confront this in modern day Paris.
Well, he didn't have to confront it. It confronted him. Mm-hmm. In fact, he says that he doesn't want to fight any more battles. He's 74 years old. He was a product of the Holocaust, and he doesn't have to fight every battle, and he's too old, but it finds him. It finds him, and mortality finds him, not only his own, but that of his little grandson who has leukemia. And that's the heart of the book, is how he can try to protect the lives of his daughter and his grandson in the way that he could not protect, because he was 4 years old, the lives of his parents who were shot in front of him. And by the way, I know this very closely, because when we did live in Paris and subsequently in the United States, we were very close to people who had survived the Holocaust. My father, in fact, brought a French family over to rescue them, and we had many people who had experienced this, including, I knew two people who saw their parents killed in front of them. And you'll see one of them anyway in the dedication of the book.
You mentioned Jules is a child of the Holocaust, and his life is so defined by the events when he was a child.
Although I have to say that one of the things that distinguishes Jules is that he refuses to be a victim of this. You know, he lives his life passionately in terms of his devotion to music and beauty and his children. He feels, as I feel, that our duty to the people who perished in the Holocaust is to live the life that they could not live, to appreciate it and to take full advantage of living, and not to be neurotic about it, and also to refuse to be a victim in all cases. There's no reason why anyone who can possibly fight needs to be a victim.
Let me just read you one thing from the very beginning of your book, because I know, Mark, you're never afraid to tackle the big concepts and the big ideas. And the very beginning of the book, you're talking about Jewel. He was a cellist and could never have been anything else. The world had courage, faith, beauty, and love, and it had music. Those are the themes that we're going to see in this book and that you often play on.
Yeah, and particularly music, too, because I'm a frustrated musician. In other words, not a musician who would love to have been a musician, but I didn't have the talent. I wish I could be a composer. I can hear things in my head, but there's no way that I'd be able to write them down.
Well, you do describe music a lot in this book as a way of expressing expressing humanity in a way that can't be expressed any other way.
That's right. I mean, I think that music is the most ineffable art. And it, as I say in the book somewhere, I think, that it takes you as far to heaven as it's possible to get without dying. And I reflected in the book upon music. He does, because he's a professional, as much as I possibly could, trying to solve the mystery of what it is that's so magnificent about it. Of course, I never got there, but I got maybe close.
And you say a few times in the book something along the lines that passion should be reserved for art and reason for politics, but things now have become the opposite.
Exactly the opposite. And it's very damaging because art has become, well, nihilistic on the one hand and cold and analytical. And then politics has now become unreasonably passionate to the point where it's damaging. And those things should be reversed. One should be able to sit down with someone of the opposite political faith and have a reasonable discussion. I used to do that. You certainly did that in graduate school where I was in those fields. And I mean, for instance, I was in the Israeli Army and Air Force. I was able to sit down and have dinner with Rashid Khalidi, who was in the PLO. We could talk about things. And this is very hard these days.
It strikes me when you talk about things that were. There's something that I underlined here in the book with Jewel, and he's talking about loyalty. He says, loyalty is like magic. It makes suffering immaterial. You're loyal to what? Being peculiar? No, I'm loyal to a world that was destroyed. Do you feel that way?
Yes, in the sense that I'm loyal to my parents, and they're dead. And I think about them all the time and will never forget them, and I feel a love toward them, which will only vanish when I'm dead. And it's something which does fortify you and give you a purpose. And I'm also loyal to, without being nostalgic, because I don't like nostalgia. It's a surface emotion. But I am loyal to certain things that have vanished, certain customs and ways of life. So what I look for is the universal, things that last through time, things that are fundamental, and which are not subject to the whim of a popular fashion. I do expect a lot of my readers, and that's an old-fashioned thing. The 19th century novel was essentially a doorstopper, and you had to put some work into it in order to get some value out. And in fact, that's a universal law of the universe. There is no free lunch. You won't get anything out of a book or a piece of music or whatever if you don't put some work into it. Work being attention, understanding, even time. And I think that people who can appreciate classical music, which takes some education and some work, would appreciate this book very much.
We've been friends for a while, and I know that you are a natural storyteller. And you've been writing since you were very, very young. And I also know that you can be shy. You've described it in interviews I've seen as a social phobia, even.
Yes.
Do you think one goes with the other?
Yeah, because there's really nothing much that I'm suited for other than sitting alone and writing stuff down.
I disagree with that.
Well, it's a miracle. It's a miracle that I've actually been able to make a living doing that. I didn't expect to, so I got into another profession as well, which most writers of the past have done, and it helps because then you don't have to write just about writing. You can write about the things and challenges and defeats that you've experienced in the world. But I happen to have lucked in terms of being able to make a very good living writing books.
That was author Mark Helprin, a featured author at the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading. And just to clear up any confusion, this is not the Mark Helprin, who's a TV journalist and has been in the news recently for sexual harassment charges. Different person. I'm Robin Sussingham. We'll be right back. This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sussingham, and today we're speaking to authors featured in the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading. Sarah Gerard's debut novel was Binary Star. Her new work is a collection of essays called Sunshine State, in which she uses her experiences growing up in the Tampa Bay area to explore intimacy, religion, homelessness, incarceration, and more. Publishers Weekly called Gerard a virtuoso of language. You were born and raised in Clearwater?
Largo. I was born in Clearwater, raised in Largo.
Largo. Okay. Yeah. So you're from this area.
Yeah.
It was very formative to you.
Oh, absolutely.
And to who you are as a writer.
Yeah, I think so. You know, growing up here, I think, how do I say this? A lot of people, when they leave, they think of escaping Florida. That's the word they use. Well, I escaped when I was, you know, 20 or something. But I actually thought of it as I had been looking for an opportunity to return to the area and sort of grapple with, like you said, the ways that it formed me as a person.
You're a young writer, and you've written one book, which was a novel, which, by the way, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Award for First Fiction. This isn't fiction. You completely changed your form of writing for this book. It's a collection of essays, Sunshine State's collection of essays. And you describe it in the book as sort of a mix of journalism and memoir.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide to change over to a collection of essays?
I guess there are a couple of contributing factors. The first is that I don't really think that fiction and nonfiction are all that different. They're very porous. It's really a matter of degree and, you know, how much do we want to adhere to capital T truth? Because Binary Star is a very autobiographical novel. The protagonist is anorexic. When I was 22, went to rehab for anorexia, and I think that was the first book I had to write only because I needed to get that story out of the way. And I have continued since then writing about food and eating and body image, and a lot of people who struggle with food also struggle with self-harm, which I began doing when I was very young, cutting myself. There are lots of contributing factors.
Does writing help?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't say that writing is a cure, you know, but it can be therapeutic. It definitely forces me to be honest with myself about my behavior. You know, if I can put something on the page in a radical way and just say, you know what, I refuse to be ashamed of this, then there's no reason for me to self-abuse.
And just going back to what you said a moment ago about truth with a capital T and how you don't know if there's much difference between fiction and nonfiction. Well, I'm in the reporting business, so that's something that I take really seriously.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see these essays? Are they true?
Oh, yeah. Every one of them is true. One of the essays, for instance, Going Diamond, it's about my parents' 4 years in Amway when I was 7 to 11 years old. In that essay, the best way to get at the truth was to include sections of fiction. Like when we were in Amway, we would go on these, they're called dream building tours of mansions in the area.
Right. I wanted you to talk about that.
Yeah.
What is dream building?
It's a way of making your dreams material reality. Like if they feel very real, then you're more likely to achieve them, you know, if they feel like they're within reach. So we would visit mansions. We would visit car dealerships and test drive cars that were way out of our budget. We would tour luxury yachts.
And they brought you along on all the dream building.
Oh, yeah. The whole family was in on Amway. And it felt really normal to me at the time, you know, and it was only in retrospect when I began to write this collection and think about some odd parts of my childhood that I could return to and explore that I began to second guess that enterprise of dream building.
And that's so interesting because that is kind of a thread that you have running through this that applies, I think, very specifically to Florida,
mm-hmm.
which is the idea of people coming here with dreams
mm-hmm.
and fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
And you get into religion and cult-like religions.
My parents were a part of the New Thought movement, which was a kind of marriage of Christian science and some Eastern thought.
How was it different than going to a Presbyterian church or something?
It's very focused on the power of thought to actualize reality. You know, positive affirmation and like denial of negative realities are supposed to bring about healing. They're supposed to have healing properties.
And this kind of goes along with the Amway dream building too, though. I mean, that kind of mindset.
Right, exactly.
If you dream it, you can make it real.
I think of those essays as being sort of companion pieces. You know, one follows from the other.
And tell me the name. The one about the Amway was called Diamonds?
Going Diamond.
Going Diamond.
When we were in Amway, Diamond was the highest level of achievement.
And so. Mother, Father, God mm-hmm. was about your experiences in this church.
Yeah, in the New Thought movement. And Mother, Father, God is actually an inversion of a common term in the New Thought movement. And Christian Science, actually, Father, Mother, God is the name that we use for God. We don't say just God. We say Father, Mother to acknowledge the feminine and the masculine.
Are you still practicing in that church?
No, I don't. But when I was writing the book, I did go to church every Sunday, and I reconnected with my childhood pastor, and I went through the church archives. And there's still, you know, there was a really deep emotional connection that I felt with the literature of the church. And, you know, of course, like the things that form us as children stay with us throughout our lives, you know? So I was hearing these prayers and they hit me on this really deep emotional level, and I just began crying sometimes in church, like, oh my God, it's this familiar thing that I haven't heard in 20 years, you know?
I wanted to have you read in this first essay, BFF, it is about your childhood best friend. And we don't often see accounts of how intense this adolescent friendship between girls can be and how physical. And when it goes bad, it's so intense, it can be worse than breaking up with your first boyfriend.
If I could quantify what came between us, the cost of tuition. If I could quantify what came between us, the cost of your mother's one-bedroom rent subtracted from my parents' four-bedroom house in a gated neighborhood. If I could quantify what came between us, the cost of diapers, formula, hospital bills. The last time we spoke before this, we planned to get coffee and you never called me back. You never showed. You disappeared. That day, I wore a pink slip I'd turned into a dress, copycatting your style, which has always been effortless. You shinier, you prettier, you taller, you thinner, more popular. In middle school, you had friends and I had you. You made it so you were my only friend. Don't think I didn't know.
Wow. Have you reconnected with this person?
I actually have, yeah, a couple of months ago. For my birthday, she posted something on Instagram that was like a direct address to me. And she said, I read the essay, but just an excerpt. Happy birthday, Sarah. You were my first love.
She needs to read the whole thing.
Oh, she has now. Yeah.
What did she say?
She actually read it as I was sitting across from her at brunch. I sat there and watched her read it. And we had a four-hour brunch. And not long ago, she said, you know, thank you for writing that. It was important for me to see myself this way.
You were not judgmental. I mean, you made it clear there were differences in money and class. You went to college. You had the money to do that. You lived in a nicer house. She became a stripper. You became a writer. But you kind of said you also weren't an angel. You were jealous. Mm-hmm. You weren't always a good friend.
Yeah, she's doing really well now. She's always been an artist. I think that was part of what was so heartbreaking, is that she, in a lot of ways, was more talented than me. And now she has two children and is putting herself through school. And she's making art, which is amazing. She's amazing. She's a great person. So I'm glad we were able to reconnect.
Did you learn anything about your relationship with this state that surprised you?
You know, I guess I don't feel anymore like it's a place I needed to escape. It's always going to be home to me.
That was Sarah Gerard, author of the essay collection Sunshine State. The prolific mystery writer William Heffernan is the author of 19 novels and winner of the Edgar Award. His new novel, The Scientology Murders, centers around protagonist Harry Doyle, a homicide detective in the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, and villains working for the Church of Scientology.
I, of course, was familiar with L. Ron Hubbard as a science fiction writer and, you know, as just an absolute charlatan. You know, him coming out and saying that if you want to make a lot of money, start your own religion. And when I moved here to Clearwater, I was just astonished at how much the Church of Scientology owned and had taken over. They virtually, had dominated the town. And so I became curious, and I wanted to see what they had going for themselves. And, of course, Hubbard was dead by then. He had gone off in his spaceship somewhere. Miscavige had taken over, and, of course, he was entirely different. I mean, where L. Ron Hubbard would go out in his boat and he'd throw people overboard when they displeased them and then pick them up and pull them back on board.
Now, is this documented? You mentioned that in the book, too.
Yeah, he talked about
that. We can't be throwing that kind of stuff out there if we don't have some other kinds of
way to. He acknowledged doing it.
So you were reading news reports?
Yes, reading news reports, people who had left the organization in fear had put out. And I was able to talk to some of them, and it was pretty frightening what was allegedly going on.
This is a murder mystery.
Yes.
And a detective story. And
yes.
Police procedural. I don't know. There's lots of
things. And it's fiction.
And it's fiction. And there's a disclaimer at the beginning of the book that you're very clear.
Of course.
But you detail what happens to the people who make trouble for the church in this book. Your protagonist, Harry Doyle, feels the full weight of the money and the lawyers and the legal problems that the church throws at him in this book. So you're well aware of it. Were you worried about what might happen to you after the book was published?
I have a friend who actually worked for the Church of Scientology as a detective. So I knew what they might do. But no, I wasn't worried. I spent years as a investigative reporter in New York City, and I was shot at. All kinds of things happened to me as a reporter that I wasn't worried about the Church of Scientology putting the arm on me.
Well, I wanted to bring that up. You reported on big city corruption and big city crime.
Yes.
When you were with the New York Daily News.
Yep.
For many years. Then you left journalism around 1980 when you got your first book contract.
Yes.
Around that time. But you didn't really leave reporting completely behind, as you say. You still have a nose for a story. You still do a lot of research.
Well, writing a book is a lot of research, especially the type of books that I write. It's probably the most fun in the early part of a book until you have to sit down and start writing. So you're doing a lot of reporting.
You're very specific about the Tampa Bay locations that you write about in this book. For instance, you don't write that Harry went to a seafood restaurant around the corner. You say that he went to Pete and Shorty's Tavern on Gulf to Bay Boulevard in mm-hmm. Clearwater. Why do you like to include those kinds of details?
Because I think people identify with that, and I identify with it, Little Greasy Spoon in Tarpon Springs, where I have breakfast occasionally. I give it a plug, and people who pick up the book and go, oh, I had breakfast there, and they like that sort of thing.
So a lot of the details from the book come from the real life that you're living.
Oh, sure. Characters come after, real people I've known to a certain extent. I mean, Harry Doyle, I don't know anybody who was killed by their mother and was brought back to life, but that's an idea that came to me, and the idea of the dead detective who then, seems to get these messages from dead people. I thought it would be a neat little trick to use.
So you did read a story about two little boys. What were they, in Florida? Who their mother tried,
yes.
And their mother tried to kill them, drugged them, left them in the garage with the car running. And then went to church. And that's where you got your idea for Harry Doyle. What's that little 10-year-old boy going to be like when he grows up?
Mm-hmm.
What if he becomes
a detective?
And what
if he became a detective?
Mm-hmm. And here we have Harry Doyle.
I mean, that's where the ideas come from. I mean, you see a story and you just start ruminating about what would happen if. And, it's all because you have a strange mind. And that's the way that it works.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to have you read this one passage, if you don't mind, because I thought this kind of sums up a lot of the book.
Harry slept fitfully and awoke a half an hour before dawn. It was cloudy and overcast, killing any chance of the beautiful sunrise he had been looking forward to, something that might drive away or at least obscure the insanity that had taken place in court the previous day. This woman, his birth mother, had killed both of her children. He had been brought back to life after his heart had stopped beating. His 6-year-old brother, Jimmy, had not been so lucky. He was now 6 feet underground, decayed in his small coffin. And his mother, the woman who had killed them both, was playing the victim with the help of a well-heeled lawyer and a corrupt executive for a church that Harry felt was little more than a money-making scam created by a demented science fiction writer who supposedly once told an interviewer that if someone wanted to become rich, they just had to start with their own religion.
It's a crazy world.
Yes.
And I guess in your reporting, did you sometimes find that life was stranger than fiction?
Look at this mass murder in this church in Texas. You know, if I brought that into my in a book to my wonderful agent, she would look at me and say, "Come on, Bill, that's too much. That's too much." But it isn't. It happens.
But if you read it in a novel, you'd think it was over the top. Yeah,
it was over the top.
Yeah.
But it's not over the top. You know, it's happening day after day after day. The shooting in Las Vegas, over the top, but not, because we're living in a crazy, crazy world. I can't write it as crazy as it is.
People wouldn't believe it.
No.
You like this character, Harry Doyle.
I do.
Will there be more Harry Doyle novels?
You know, I don't know. It's...
This is the second.
Yes. The problem is the killer in this book. You have to lock yourself in a room with that character for a year. I don't know if I can lock myself in the room with another character like that for a year. It's hard.
He was very creepy.
Yes. And you have to live with him. And he takes over the book, too.
Yeah.
He takes over a portion of your life as well when you're writing about him. And it's not pleasant, but it's, you know, he's part of the book.
That was William Heffernan, author of The Scientology Murders. Earlier, I spoke with Mark Helprin and Sarah Gerard. They're featured authors at the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading. Do you have a favorite author at the festival? Let us know on Facebook or tweet us at Florida Matters. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. The producer is Stephanie Colombini, and the engineer is Craig George. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.